struggles. My gods against your gods, my immortality project against your immortality project. In other words, we'll fight so hard to preserve our symbolic immortality that we will sacrifice our physical lives. In order to deny death, we will die. Even worse, we will deny that this is what we are doing, until the point at which we can deny it no longer. One of the main reasons that it's so easy to march men off to war, Becker observes, bleakly, is that deep down, each of them feels sorry for the man next to him who will die. Each protects himself in this fantasy until the shock that he is bleeding. If Becker is right, the wondrous fact that we behave as if we're immortal isn't so wondrous after all. You don't fail to think about your mortality. Rather, your life is one relentless attempt to avoid doing so, a struggle so elemental that, unlike in the case of the White Bear Challenge, for much of the time, you succeed. A few years after the denial of death became a bestseller, several experimentally minded psychologists realized that Becker's speculations, and powerful as they were just speculations, could easily be subjected to a more scientific test. If Becker is correct that we spend our lives fiercely but subconsciously trying to evade thoughts of our own death, it ought to follow that people who are explicitly reminded of their mortality, who are in the language of psychology experiments primed to think about it, would instinctively fight back by clinging ever harder to their death-denying beliefs and behaviours. This is the hunch underlying the field known evocatively as terror management theory, which over the last two decades has generated numerous persuasive examples of just how deeply the denial of death affects us. One typical set of terror management experiments at Rutgers University in New Jersey in 2003 unfolded as follows. First, the participants were fed a banal cover story about why they'd been invited to take part. The study, they were informed, concerned the relationship between personality attributes and opinions about social issues. Mortality wasn't mentioned. Then they were asked to fill out some lengthy and largely mundane questionnaires, which were identical for each participant except when it came to two specific questions. For one set of respondents, those questions were about something mundane too, their television watching habits. For the others, described as the mortality salience group, the questions focused on death. One was, "Please briefly describe the emotions that the thought of your own death arouses in you." The other question demanded that respondents jot down as specifically as you can what you think will happen to you as you physically die and once you are physically dead. Then came a second exercise, which was the study's real point. Participants were asked to read a short essay that expressed strong support for the foreign policies of George Bush, then to decide how far they agreed with it. "Personally," read the essay, "I endorse the actions of President Bush and the members of his administration who have taken bold action in Iraq. I appreciate our president's wisdom regarding the need to remove Saddam Hussein from power. We need to stand behind our president and not be distracted by citizens who are less than patriotic." Again and again, in terror management experiments, people who have been shifted into this condition of mortality salience, prompted to think about death, demonstrate markedly different attitudes from those who haven't. Their responses to questions lend weight to the hypothesis that they are grasping hold of their immortality projects much more firmly than usual, in reaction against being reminded that they will die. Christians show more negativity towards Jews. Moralistic people become more moralistic. Where money is involved, people become less willing to share or to trust, and more eager to hoard whatever wealth they can. And at Rutgers in 2003, when asked how far they shared the views of the essay about President Bush, people in a state of mortality salience were significantly more willing to endorse its author's fighting talk. Other studies have shown a similar preference, in conditions of mortality salience, for authoritarian personalities over relationship-oriented ones. It seems clear that Bush benefited greatly from mortality salience effects in the real world as well. The terrorist attacks of 9/11 would have functioned like an extreme version of the death questions on a terror management questionnaire, startling anyone who heard the news into the realization that they, too, could go into the office one ordinary morning and die. It is fear that makes people so willing to follow brash, strong-looking demagogues with tight jaws and loud voices, wrote Becker. Leaders who seem most capable of cleansing the world of the vague, the weak, the uncertain, the evil. Ah, to give oneself over to their direction. What calm, what relief. Mortality salience makes itself felt in numerous other, sometimes unexpected ways. Experimental subjects who've been prompted to think about death demonstrate more intense reactions of disgust to discussions of human bodily waste. They agree more strongly with statements such as, "If I see someone vomit, it makes me sick to my stomach." They're more likely to rank certain hypothetical scenarios as very disgusting, for example, seeing maggots on a piece of meat. This response, researchers argue, shows that participants are struggling to buffer themselves against confronting reminders of their creatureliness, of the fact that, like other animals, they're physically mortal. Disgust, one such paper states, enables humans to elevate themselves above other animals and thereby defend against death. This reaction to mortality, following Becker's logic, may also help explain some cultures' taboos against menstruating women and why defecation and urination are generally done in private. People in a condition of mortality salience, it transpires, are also more likely to be sympathetic to the theory of intelligent design, perhaps for similar reasons. If you can convince yourself that life didn't emerge meaninglessly from the primordial swamp, it's easier to feel that it won't end in meaningless extinction, either. In view of all this, the argument that it could be beneficial to live with more daily consciousness of one's mortality might sound impractical at best. For one thing, Becker's argument seems to suggest that the denial of death is far too deep-rooted for us ever to hope to unseat it. Besides, if it's the motivation for all sorts of extraordinary human achievements, would you really even want to do so? Yet since the time of the ancient Greeks, certain radical thinkers have taken the position that a life suffused with an awareness of one's own mortality, as a matter of everyday habit, not just when direct encounters with death force our hand, might be a far richer kind of existence. It's also surely a more authentic one. Death is a fact of life, however hard we might try to deny it. In fact, the cult of optimism, with its focus on positivity at all costs, can itself be seen as a kind of immortality project. One that promises a future vision of happiness and success so powerful and all-encompassing that it might somehow transcend death. Positive thinkers, it's true, do pay lip service to mortality awareness, with their homilies about living each day as if it were your last. But this is usually delivered as mere motivational advice, as a spur to get moving, to start realizing your greatest ambitions. And if those ambitions are themselves simply more immortality projects, we've not really come any closer to living with an awareness of death. Ernest Becker's appointment with mortality came tragically early. A year before the denial of death was published, he was diagnosed with colon cancer at the age of 47. 2 years later, Sam Keen visited him, literally on his deathbed, in a hospital ward in Vancouver one rainy day in February 1974. Keen was there to conduct an interview with Becker for Psychology Today. "Well," Becker told him, "now you'll have a chance to see whether I lived as I thought." He had requested only a minimum of pain-killing medication, he explained, so as to remain clear in his final interactions with his family and in his dying. The denial of death might have structured all human civilization, but it wasn't the best way, Becker believed, for an individual to deal with his own death. "Gradually, reluctantly," Keane wrote later, "we are beginning to acknowledge that the bitter medicine Becker prescribes, contemplation of the horror of our own death, is paradoxically the tincture that adds sweetness to mortality." The interview was published a month after their meeting, in March. A few days afterwards, Becker died. It may be hard to swallow the idea that we should spend more time contemplating death, but there are some powerful and pragmatic arguments for doing so. Consider, for example, the Stoic technique of the premeditation of evils. Death is going to happen, Seneca would say, and so it must be preferable to be mentally prepared for its approach, instead of shocked into the sudden realization that it is imminent. In any case, our subconscious strivings not to think about death are never entirely successful. Long before your own death becomes a probability, you'll occasionally find yourself in the grip of that middle-of-the-night panic so vividly captured by Philip Larkin in his poem Aubard. "Unresting death, a whole day nearer now, flashes afresh to hold and horrify." Better, surely, to avoid such horror by normalizing the prospect if possible. But how to go about doing this? The denial of death isn't like most other problems, which weigh on us so heavily that we may eventually be driven to find a way to solve them. The whole problem is that most of the time it doesn't feel like a problem at all. Subconsciously assuming that you're immortal makes for a much easier existence, so long as you can keep it up. How, then, to fight this instinct and choose, as a matter of daily living, to confront death instead? Solving this conundrum sounded like it might be a job for someone who was both a philosopher and a psychotherapist, and so in search of answers I turned to Lauren Tillinghast, a woman whose business cards and website described her as a philosophical counsellor. She was part of a contemporary movement among philosophers who felt that they were returning the discipline to its Socratic roots, as a therapeutic practice intended to soothe the soul, not just an academic exercise in theory spinning. Tillinghast did her fair share of such theorizing. She'd published articles in philosophy journals with titles such as What is an Attributive Adjective? And The Classificatory Sense of Art. But she also had a consulting office in downtown Manhattan, a bright and neatly furnished room hidden inside an aging office building that was home to a number of more conventional therapists, psychiatrists, and counselors. She was in her early 40s and had the practiced, friendly neutrality of a woman accustomed to listening non-judgmentally to other people's problems. She poured me some mint tea into a white china cup, ushered me to an armchair, and didn't flinch when I told her I wanted to talk about death, and specifically how one might learn to choose to live with greater awareness of one's mortality. "Well, that's a pretty big topic," she said. But we had to start somewhere, and we decided to begin with Epicurus. The first step in trying to become more comfortable with your mortality involves attempting to reduce the terror induced by the mere thought of death. If you can't manage that, you're unlikely to get much further. Tillinghast explained that philosophers had often sought to achieve this by means of rational argument. If you can be persuaded that the fear of death is illogical, you're more likely to be able to let go of it. The ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus, a contemporary of Zeno of Citium, the original Stoic, had made one of the earliest attempts. Before him, the philosophical consensus on death, broadly speaking, was that it wasn't really final. The best argument for not being scared of it was that a glorious afterlife might follow. Epicurus's argument is the mirror image of this. If life doesn't continue beyond death, he points out, that's an excellent reason not to be scared of it either. Death is nothing to us, he says, since when we are, death has not come, and when death has come, we are not. You might fear a painful dying process. You might dread the pain of losing others to death. Our focus here is not on the terrible pain of grief. But fearing being dead yourself makes no sense. Death spells the end of the experiencing subject, and thus the end of any capacity for experiencing the state we fear. Or as Einstein put it, the fear of death is the most unjustified of all fears, for there's no risk of accident to one who's dead. The one great fear that governs our lives, from this perspective, stands exposed as a kind of error. It's as if, instead of imagining death, we had all along been imagining something more like being buried alive, deprived of all the benefits of existence, yet somehow still forced to experience the deprivation. One powerful counterargument to this position is that our fear doesn't come from imagining death wrongly, but from the fact that we can't imagine it at all. That was roughly Freud's view of the matter, that what we call the fear of death is really more of a horrified seizing up in the face of something utterly inconceivable. But as the contemporary philosopher Thomas Nagel points out, there's something wrong with this argument too, because there's nothing about unimaginable states that is terrifying by definition. We can't imagine what it's like to be in a state of dreamless sleep either, but we surrender to it every night, and very few of us do so with feelings of terror. People who are averse to death, Nagel notes dryly, are not usually averse to unconsciousness. Epicurus has a second connected point to make about the non-scariness of death, which has become known as the argument of symmetry. Why do you fear the eternal oblivion of death, he wonders, if you don't look back with horror at the eternal oblivion before you were born, which, as far as you were concerned, was just as eternal, and just as much an oblivion? Vladimir Nabokov famously opens his memoir Speak Memory with lines that drive this point home. The cradle rocks above an abyss, and common sense tells us that our existence is but a brief crack of light between two eternities of darkness. Although the two are identical twins, man, as a rule, views the prenatal abyss with much more calm than the one he is headed for. If you weren't traumatized by not having yet been born, it seems logical not to worry about being traumatized by being dead. But of course, Tillinghast pointed out, it's not very useful for most people to point out that a fear is illogical. It doesn't make it go away. There's another problem with all these efforts to make being dead a less frightening prospect, which is this. Who says that being dead is the problem in the first place? When we contemplate our own personal mortality, the real sting is surely that we're going to stop being alive and lose all the benefits we enjoy as a result of living. People don't generally come to me because they fear the oblivion of being dead, Tillinghast said. But the idea of everything that makes life lifely drawing to a close, well, that's a much greater source of anxiety. It's true, of course, that you won't be around to experience being deprived of those benefits, so fearing that deprivation is arguably unjustifiable. But as Nagel argues in an essay entitled simply Death, the fact that you shouldn't fear death doesn't mean that it isn't a bad thing. By way of analogy, he says, imagine an adult who suffers a severe brain injury and is reduced to the mental state of a 3-year-old. He might be perfectly happy in his new condition, but nobody would disagree that something bad had still happened to the adult he once was. It makes no difference that the adult is no longer around. No matter how persuasive you find Epicurus' arguments against fearing death, it doesn't follow that death is not bad. This distinction is crucial because it begins to make sense of the idea that a greater degree of mortality awareness might be part of the recipe for happiness. For as long as you're terrified by the idea of your mortality, you can't really be expected to swallow Ernest Becker's bitter medicine and voluntarily opt to spend more time thinking about your own death. On the other hand, trying to embrace death as a good thing would seem to be asking far too much of yourself. It might not necessarily even be desirable, since it could cause you to place less value on being alive. But coming to understand death as something that there's no reason to fear, yet which is still bad because of what it brings to an end, might be the ideal middle path. The argument is a thoroughly down-to-earth, pragmatic, and stoic one. The more that you remain aware of life's finitude, the more you will cherish it, and the less likely you will be to fritter it away on distractions. Look at it like going to a really nice restaurant, said Tillinghast. You take it as a fact that the meal isn't going to last forever. Never mind if that's the way it should be, or whether you feel like you're owed more meal, or you resent the fact that the meal isn't eternal. It's just the case that you have this one meal. So it would make sense, wouldn't it, to try to suck the marrow out of it, to focus on the flavours, to not let yourself be distracted by irritation at the fact that there's a woman at the next table wearing too much perfume. The psychotherapist Irvin Yalom, in his book Staring at the Sun, points out that many of us live with the dim fear that on our deathbeds we'll come to regret how we spent our lives. Remembering our mortality moves us closer to the deathbed mindset from which such a judgment might be made, thus enabling us to spend our lives in ways that we're much less likely to come to regret. Truly to confront your own mortality, Yalom argues, is to undergo an awakening, a total shift in perspective that fundamentally transforms how it feels to be alive. And it's not necessarily remotely pleasant. He recalls the reflections of one of his therapy patients, a woman in her early 30s. I suppose the strongest feelings came, she told him, from realizing that it would be me who will die, not some other entity like old lady me or terminally ill and ready to die me. I suppose I always thought of death obliquely as something that might happen rather than that would happen. To make that switch, Yalom insists, is not merely to ratchet up the intensity with which you live, but to alter your relationship to life. It's a transformation he describes, borrowing the language of the philosopher Martin Heidegger, as a move from focusing on how things are to the fact that things are, on the sheer astonishing isness of existence. This is the real distinction between mortality awareness as a way of life, on the one hand, and those clichéd slogans about living each day as if it were your last, on the other. The slogans may be motivational, a reminder to get down to the important stuff before it's too late. But Yalom is talking about a transformation that redefines what constitutes the important stuff. When you really face mortality, the ultimate and unavoidable worst-case scenario, everything changes. All external expectations, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important, Apple's founder Steve Jobs once said in a speech that was speedily co-opted by several gurus of positive thinking, though in truth its message struck fatally at the heart of theirs. Remembering that you're going to die is the best way that I know to avoid the trap of thinking that you have something to lose. You're already naked. Start thinking this way, Yalom points out, and it becomes a virtuous circle. Living more meaningfully will reduce your anxiety about the possibility of future regret at not having lived meaningfully, which will in turn keep sapping death of its power to induce anxiety. As he puts it, there's a positive correlation between the fear of death and the sense of unlived life. Live a life suffused with the awareness of its own finitude, and you can hope to finish it in something like the fashion that Jean-Paul Sartre hoped to die, quietly, certain that the last burst of my heart would be inscribed on the last page of my work, and that death would be taking only a dead man. After wrestling for a while with the ideas of Becker, Epicurus, Thomas Nagel, and Irvin Yalom, I decided to take a trip to Mexico. I had suspected for some time that this would prove necessary if I was really going to understand the role of mortality awareness in daily life. I'd often seen it claimed that Mexico had a unique attitude towards death. By common agreement, it was one of the few countries that still had an active tradition of memento mori, rituals and customs designed to encourage regular reflections on mortality. And according to several recent international surveys, it was also one of the happiest, perhaps even the happiest or second happiest nation in the world, in fact, depending on the measures used. The most famous example of this attitude towards death is the annual celebration known as the Day of the Dead, when Mexicans toast those who have died, and death itself, with copious quantities of tequila and bread in the shape of human remains. People build shrines in their homes, throng city squares, and conduct all-night vigils at the graves of deceased relatives. But this way of thinking runs deeper than a national holiday each November. As the celebrated Mexican essayist Octavio Paz writes in his book The Labyrinth of Solitude, the word death is not pronounced in New York, in Paris, in London, because it burns the lips. The Mexican, in contrast, is familiar with death, jokes about it, caresses it, sleeps with it, celebrates it. It is one of his favorite toys and his most steadfast love. This more intimate relationship with mortality was not always so unusual. Such traditions date at least to ancient Rome. There, according to legend, generals who had been victorious in battle would instruct a slave to follow behind as they paraded through the streets. The slave's task was to keep repeating, for the general's benefit, a warning against hubris. Memento mori, remember you shall die. Much later, in Christian Europe, memento mori became a staple of the visual arts. Symbols of death appeared frequently in still life paintings, sometimes including skulls intended to represent those of the artist's patrons. Public clocks featured automata representing death, and sometimes the Latin slogan vulnerant omnis ultima necat as a reminder of the effects of the passing minutes. Every hour wounds, and the last one kills. The specific motivation for contemplating mortality differed from era to era and culture to culture. In the ancient world, it had much to do with remembering to savour life as if it were a delicious meal, as Lauren Tillinghast had advised. For later Christians, it was often more a case of remembering to behave well in anticipation of the final judgment. I'd been especially intrigued to hear about one contemporary example of death awareness in Mexican daily life. Santa Muerte was the name of a new religion, according to its followers, or a satanic cult in the eyes of the Catholic Church, which worshipped death itself, the figure known as La Santa Muerte, or Saint Death. The movement had sprung up several decades ago in the toughest neighborhoods of Mexico City, among prostitutes and drug dealers and the very poor, people for whom both the Mexican government and the Catholic Church had failed to provide. Instead, they prayed to Santa Muerte for protection from death, for a gentle death, or sometimes for death to their enemies. Now, as a result of immigration, Santa Muerte had spread to parts of the United States. It was also said that some of Mexico's most powerful businessmen and politicians kept secret death shrines at home. And although many of the followers of Saint Death were law-abiding Mexicans, they had marched in the streets to protest the government's attempts to characterize the movement as nothing but a band of criminals, it was nonetheless true that it had become the religion of choice of the narcotraficantes, the ruthless drug-smuggling gangs of Mexico's north. At the movement's main shrine in the barrio of Tepito in Mexico City, where a life-sized model of a skeleton laden with jewelry stood in a glass case on a side street, some of the country's most violent men came to leave offerings of dollar bills, cigarettes, and marijuana. Whatever other significance the movement had, being a follower of Santa Muerte seemed to entail devoting oneself to an especially extreme form of memento mori, to organizing one's life around the omnipresence of death. In a world of facts, writes Paz, death is merely one more fact. But since it is such a disagreeable fact, contrary to all our concepts and to the very meaning of our lives, the philosophy of progress pretends to make it disappear, like a magician palming a coin. In Mexico, Santa Muerte was where you turned if the circumstances of your life made this sleight of hand impossible, if the constant fear of violent death removed the option of ignoring your mortality. I did visit Tepito during my time in Mexico, a few days before the Day of the Dead itself, although it didn't prove the most successful of assignments. I'd been warned not to get there by hailing a taxi from the street, because of the risk of kidnapping. As a reporter, I have no real thirst for danger, and arguably I shouldn't have gone at all. Foreigners, for obvious reasons, never go to Tepito, someone advised, in an internet forum that I probably shouldn't have consulted. Only idiots and the ignorant visit Tepito, warned someone else. A few days earlier, an armed gang had gunned down 6 people on a street corner there in the middle of the day. In the newspapers, it was reported that the police had written off whole sections of it as too dangerous to bother trying to patrol. A filmmaker based in Mexico City, who'd made a documentary about Tepito, declined to accompany me there, citing safety concerns. And a restaurateur in a smarter part of the city had cheerily passed along what she claimed was a well-known saying. In Tepito, even the rats carried guns. My walk into Tepito was therefore, if nothing else, a pretty good exercise in memento mori for myself. I set off from the heart of the city in the middle of the morning, through shopping streets and Mexico City's business district, then along bigger highways lined with scrappy, busy markets, until the streets grew narrower and the buildings smaller again, and I found myself in Tepito. The core of the neighbourhood was another cacophonous market. Tepito is notorious as a centre for the sale of counterfeit and stolen goods. But in my search for the Santa Muerte shrine, I soon left the main roads and plunged into the deserted back streets, where rats scuttled from towering piles of rubbish. I hurried past darkened doorways, growing nervous. In the event, the scene at the shrine was festive. Around 20 people were waiting in an orderly line to pay their respects to the skeleton, which was resplendent in purple and orange necklaces and a lace shawl. Some carried their own smaller statuettes or bottles of spirits to leave as a gift. One or two blew cigar or cigarette smoke over the skeleton when they came to the front of the line, in what I later learned was a rite of spiritual cleansing. The devotees chatted and laughed, men and women, elderly women and muscular young men, some with newborn babies and toddlers in tow. Having been unable to persuade a translator to come with me to the barrio, I was forced to rely on my terrible Spanish to start a conversation with a woman carrying a foot-high death statue under her arm. Several other people in the line turned to stare. She didn't want to talk. The atmosphere in my immediate vicinity quickly turned less festive. I was intruding. Besides, it was quite possible that some of those around me wouldn't want to talk to any reporter or any stranger. People came to Santa Muerte, according to the Mexican essayist Homero Arregis, to ask her, "Protect me tonight because I'm going to kidnap or assault somebody." It was a struggle to imagine a life in which death played quite so central a role. Then again, the great truth that was underlined by the scene at the shrine, where the generations mingled as they waited in line, was that death was a subject in which everyone had an inescapable interest. As a pale, skinny Englishman, though, I was prominently out of place. And a muscular man in a black sleeveless vest who seemed to be standing guard over the shrine appeared to have noticed this. He glared at me. There was as much amusement as menace in his glare, since it was embarrassingly plain that I posed him no physical threat. Still, he tilted his head in such a way as to indicate the direction in which he believed I should now proceed, away from the shrine and back to the main street. It was shortly after this that I made the decision to leave Tepito. I had better luck on the Day of the Dead itself. Celebrations begin on the last day of October, but the festival reaches its peak on the 2nd of November. Through a friend of a colleague, I had made contact with a local retired taxi driver named Francisco, who spoke decent English and had a sideline as a fixer for journalists visiting Mexico City. At dusk, he pulled up outside my hotel in a severely battered grey van. "It's a very safe car," he said, beaming, though I hadn't asked, then added, "My other car was in an accident, and now my brother cannot use his leg." I didn't pursue the subject. Francisco, as he'd explained to me on the phone a few days earlier, knew his way round the tiny settlements in the countryside outside the capital, where the Day of the Dead was still auténtico, not commercialized or touristic, but haunting and pure, and where villagers spent the entire night conducting vigils in local cemeteries, communing with the corpses of their relatives. It wasn't really in my interests to start quibbling about road safety. In Mexico City, the official municipal celebrations were reaching their peak. The historical central square, the Zócalo, was packed with families strolling among carts selling bone-shaped bread and sugar skulls. People, adults and children, were everywhere dressed as death. Boys as hollow-eyed vampires in stiff, starched collars. Women as La Catrina, the iconic Mexican image of death as a woman in a broad-brimmed hat. On many corners, there were altars to the dead bedecked with papier-mâché skulls. Such traditions stretched back centuries, but they'd been integrated into the life of a busy modern city. In the offices of banks and insurance companies downtown, I'd been told, desks were often turned into altars. It was commonplace for colleagues to write comic poetry to each other, predicting the manner in which they might die. But Francisco and I were headed away from the bustling squares, onto wide, chaotic highways, dodging stray dogs and suicidally piloted minibuses, and then, as night fell, on empty, unlit country lanes. "You know," Francisco said after we'd passed another dimly illumined roadside statue of death looming from the blackness, "when I was a child, on this day, we would go from house to house to make a joke about how each person was going to die. So if someone smokes too much, you brought him cigarettes to make a joke about how he was going to die from too much smoking." He smiled at the memory. "Or if there was someone who lived in that house who had died from too much smoking, then you could bring cigarettes as a gift to remember him." "Didn't people get offended?" "Offended? You know, insulted." "No, why?" He turned to look at me. "I think that this is only in Mexico, though." He was largely right about that. Elsewhere in the Catholic world, November the 2nd is All Souls Day, designated since the 8th century as an occasion for mournful remembrance of the dead. But when the conquistadors reached Mexico in the 15th century, they encountered celebrations of death among the Mayan and Aztec populations far more elaborate than their own. The Aztecs honoured their Lady of the Dead, Mictlacahuatl, with a 2-month festival of bonfires, dance and feasting. The colonists were determined to replace all this with something more somber and more Christian. The Day of the Dead, with its strange mixture of Christianity and pre-Christian religions, mourning and humour, is a testament to the incompleteness of their victory. There were cultures that took memento mori to even greater extremes. The 16th century essayist Michel de Montaigne was fond of praising the ancient Egyptians, who, in the height of their feasting and mirth, caused a dried skeleton of a man to be brought into the room to serve as a memento to their guests. A writer's working space, Montaigne also believed, ought to have a good view of the cemetery. It tended to sharpen one's thinking. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the formative texts of Buddhism, the Buddha urges his monks to travel to charnel grounds in order to seek out, as objects upon which to meditate, one of the following: a corpse, 1 or 2 days old, swollen up, blue-black in colour, full of corruption, a corpse eaten by crows, a framework of bones, flesh hanging from it, bespattered with blood, held together by the sinews, bones scattered in all directions, bleached and resembling shells, bones heaped together after the lapse of years, weathered and crumbled to dust. Corpse practice, as it was known, was intended to lead the meditating monk to the realization that, as the Buddha is supposed to have phrased it, "this body of mine also has this nature, has this density, cannot escape it." Francisco and I drove on. Eventually, after a diversion to a tiny town to eat pork chilaquiles from a roadside stall, and to watch a procession of churchgoers bearing framed photographs of dead relatives, we arrived at his intended destination, the village of San Gregorio Atlapulco. It was chilly and almost midnight. At first, all I could see was an orange glow in the black sky. Then, rounding a bend in the road, we came suddenly upon its source. The village cemetery was covered in hundreds of candles and blanketed everywhere in marigold petals, sending a soft orange light into the sky. Francisco parked the van and we walked into the cemetery. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to what I was seeing. Many of the gravestones were only rough concrete slabs or stubby pieces of wood, but almost none were unattended. Next to each, sitting in folding chairs or cross-legged on the ground, were groups of two, three or four people, sometimes more, holding murmured conversations and drinking tequila from paper cups. In one corner, a mariachi band in full costume strolled from grave to grave, serenading every headstone in turn. I stopped a woman who was carrying armfuls of rugs and chairs towards a nearby headstone and asked what she was doing. "Oh, it's my mother," she said brightly, gesturing at the grave. "We come every year." It would be entirely wrong to give the impression that the Day of the Dead, or Mexico's approach to Memento Mori in general, for that matter, represented any kind of shortcut around the inescapable and scarring realities of grief. The participants in the cemetery vigils were not, by and large, those still reeling from the impact of having recently been bereaved. The idea, in any case, was not to adopt a rictus grin in the face of death. That approach is surely the cult of optimism at its worst. It doesn't work, and even if it did, it wouldn't be an appropriate response to loss. The Day of the Dead is not an effort to remake something horrifying as something unproblematic. It is precisely a rejection of such binary categories. What was happening in the cemetery was memento mori at its most powerful, a ritual that neither repressed thoughts of death nor sought, in the manner of an American or British Halloween, to render it saccharine and harmless. It was about letting death seep back into life. "In our tradition," observes the writer Victor Landa, who was raised in Mexico, "people die three deaths. The first is when our bodies cease to function, when our hearts no longer beat of their own accord, when our gaze no longer has depth or weight, when the space we occupy slowly loses its meaning. The second death comes when the body is lowered into the ground. The third death, the most definitive death, is when there is no one left alive to remember us." Death was omnipresent that night in the cemetery, and yet, precisely as a consequence of that, the third kind of death was absent. An entire town was remembering, and remembering, too, their own mortality, which differed from their dead relatives only in the sense that it hadn't claimed them yet. You need not engage in cemetery vigils to practice memento mori, however. You can start much smaller. The psychologist Russ Harris suggests a simple exercise. Imagine you're 80 years old, assuming you're not 80 already, that is. If you are, you'll have to pick an older age. And then complete the sentences, "I wish I'd spent more time on," and "I wish I'd spent less time on." This turns out to be a surprisingly effective way to achieve mortality awareness in short order. Things fall into place. It becomes far easier to follow Lauren Tillinghast's advice, to figure out what, specifically, you might do in order to focus on life's flavours, so as to improve your chances of reaching death, having lived life as fully and as deeply as possible. This kind of smaller habit may actually be the most powerful form of memento mori, for it is precisely through such mundane and unassuming rituals that we can best hope to enfold an awareness of death into the daily rhythms of life, and thus achieve something of Epicurus's calm rationality in the face of mortality. What lingered in my mind for months after Mexico, in any case, wasn't the loud celebration of death, though I had seen some of that in central Mexico City. Instead, it was the sense I'd absorbed in San Gregorio Atlapulco of relaxing alongside mortality, of comfortably coexisting with it, of the companionship of life and death. Before we left the village that night, some time before 2 in the morning, I noticed an elderly woman sitting alone on a folding chair near one of the cemetery's boundary walls. She was wrapped in a shawl and appeared to be talking softly to a headstone. Tentatively, I approached her. Interrupting felt wrong, but she wasn't hostile. Smiling, she nodded at the ledge beside the grave, inviting me to sit. So I sat. The strains of the mariachi band drifted over from the other side of the cemetery. Some families, I noticed, had built small wood fires to keep warm. A few feet away, Francisco clapped his arms around himself in an effort to generate heat. I looked out over the cemetery, strewn with marigolds and crowded with huddled figures. Beyond its edges, no lights illuminated the blackness, but inside, the fires and the hundreds of flickering candles lent the night a kind of coziness despite the chill. The musicians carried on playing. Death was in the air, and all was well. Epilogue. Negative capability. In December 1817, the poet John Keats, then 22 years old, went to see the annual Christmas pantomime at the Theatre Royal in London's Drury Lane. Also in attendance was his friend, the critic Charles Wentworth Dilke, and as they strolled home, the two men fell into conversation about writing, and specifically about the nature of literary genius. Somewhere between the theatre in Soho and his home in Hampstead, Keats was struck by a realisation, which he set down several days later in a letter to his brothers. That letter records what one Keats biographer has called a touchstone moment in the history of literature. Keats writes, "I had not a dispute but a disquisition with Dilke on various subjects. Several things dovetailed in my mind, and at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean, negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason." There is something both awe-inspiring and perhaps faintly irritating about a 22-year-old not only capable of such insights, but capable of having them so casually on the way home from the pantomime. For Keats, such observations had always come effortlessly and frequently, as in some sense they needed to. 3 years later, he was dead. He thought so little of negative capability, in fact, that he never used the phrase in writing again, thereby generously providing future literary scholars with the opportunity to write entire books dedicated to unpicking what he might have meant. At this point in our journey along the negative path to happiness, however, the outline of what he was saying ought at least to sound familiar. Sometimes the most valuable of all talents is to be able not to seek resolution, to notice the craving for completeness or certainty or comfort, and not to feel compelled to follow where it leads. Keats thought this addiction to certainty and completion was Dilke's biggest flaw, and the poet's verdict on his friend neatly encapsulates a theme we've encountered many times already. "He will never come at a truth so long as he lives," Keats wrote, "because he is always trying at it." It was the trying, the irritable reaching, that was the whole problem. More loosely defined, negative capability is really just another term for living in accordance with the backwards law, and it might be a good label to describe the chief talent I kept discovering among the people I encountered in the course of researching this book. What they all shared was this same turn of mind, which I came to visualize as a sort of graceful mental dance step, a willingness to adopt an oblique stance towards one's own inner life, to pause and take a step back, to turn to face what others might flee from, and to realize that the shortest apparent route to a positive mood is rarely a sure path to a more profound kind of happiness. The phrase negative capability also helps to clarify a subtle double meaning in the word negative. It refers both to a set of skills that involve not doing, as opposed to doing, a negative kind of capability, as well as to the fact that this skill involves confronting negative, as in unpleasant, thoughts, emotions, and situations. The point here is not that negative capability is always superior to the positive kind. Optimism is wonderful. Goals can sometimes be useful. Even positive thinking and positive visualization have their benefits. The problem is that we've developed the habit of chronically overvaluing positivity and the skills of doing in how we think about happiness, and that we chronically undervalue negativity and the not-doing skills, such as resting in uncertainty or getting friendly towards failure. To use an old cliché of therapy speak, we spend too much of our lives seeking closure. Even those of us who mock such clichés are often motivated by a craving to put an end to uncertainty and anxiety, whether by convincing ourselves that the future is bright, or by resigning ourselves despondently to the expectation that it won't be. What we need more of, instead, is what the psychologist Paul Pearsall called openture. Yes, this is an awkward neologism, but its very awkwardness is a reminder of the spirit that it expresses, which includes embracing imperfection and easing up on the search for neat solutions. The various approaches we have explored here frequently contradict each other on the level of details. Sometimes they seem so intrinsically paradoxical as practically to contradict themselves. But in this broader sense, they all embody negative capability. For the Stoics, the realization that we can often choose not to be distressed by events, even if we can't choose events themselves, is the foundation of tranquility. For the Buddhists, a willingness to observe the inner weather of your thoughts and emotions is the key to understanding that they need not dictate your actions. Each of these is a different way of resisting the irritable reaching after better circumstances or better thoughts and feelings. But negative capability need not involve embracing an ancient philosophical or religious tradition. It's also the skill you're exhibiting when you move forward with a project or with life in the absence of sharply defined goals, when you dare to inspect your failures, when you stop trying to eliminate feelings of insecurity, or when you put aside motivational techniques in favor of actually getting things done. You might choose, of course, to dedicate your life to Stoicism, like Keith Seddon in his Wizard's Cottage in Watford. You might undergo a completely life-transforming experience in the manner of Eckhart Tolle. But you can also treat these ideas as a toolkit, from which tools can be borrowed as necessary. Anyone can become somewhat Stoic, or a bit more Buddhist, or practice memento mori a little more frequently. Unlike far too many self-help schemes, which purport to be comprehensive guides to life, the negative path to happiness isn't an all-or-nothing affair. True negative capability entails moderation and balance and refraining from too much effortful struggling, including in the practice of negative capability. Proficiency and the results of proficiency, wrote Aldous Huxley, come only to those who have learned the paradoxical art of doing and not doing, of combining relaxation with activity, of letting go as a person in order that the imminent and transcendent unknown quantity may take hold. And the end result of all this? The chief benefit of openture, Paul Pearsall claimed, is not certitude or even calm or comfort as we normally think of them, but rather the strange, excited comfort of being presented with and grappling with the tremendous mysteries life offers. Ultimately, what defines the cult of optimism and the culture of positive thinking, even in its most mystically tinged New Age forms, is that it abhors a mystery. It seeks to make things certain, to make happiness permanent and final. And yet, this kind of happiness, even if you do manage to achieve it, is shallow and unsatisfying. The greatest benefit of negative capability, the true power of negative thinking, is that it lets the mystery back in. One of the worst things about being a motivational speaker or any other kind of advocate for the power of positive thinking must be the constant pressure to seem upbeat. If anyone ever catches you scowling or stressed or feeling sorry for yourself, all very normal occurrences for anybody, of course, it threatens to undermine everything you stand for. Becoming an advocate for the power of negative thinking, as I gradually did, holds no such hazard. Bad moods are permitted. Still, the ultimate purpose of all these adventures in negativity was supposed to be happiness. So you'd be entitled to wonder whether the philosophies and psychological techniques I encountered actually made me any happier, and which of them, after all the travelling and the reporting was over, retained a place in my life. Did the negative path to happiness really work? To answer that question with a simple yes or no, or to offer up a list of 10 surefire tips for negative thinking success, would be to violate the ethos of the thing. Openture surely demands that we resist such tempting certainties. But I can offer an interim status report. I didn't make it a regular habit to humiliate myself on public transport systems in major cities. Nor did I relocate to rural Mexico to live a life infused with death. So far, I haven't even been on another silent meditation retreat since my week in Massachusetts. But in numerous smaller ways, a modest degree of negative capability has become my daily practice. Few days now go by without some occasion on which I'll deploy what I've come to think of as the Stoic pause, which is all that it takes to remember that it's my judgment about the infuriating colleague, or the heavy traffic, or the burned food that is the cause of my distress, not the situation itself. Even 5 or 10 minutes Vipassana meditation, meanwhile, which I manage most mornings, is sufficient to feel as if I've applied a squirt of WD-40 to my mental machinery. For the rest of the day, problematic thoughts and emotions slip by with far less friction. Eckhart Tolle's deceptively simple-sounding question, "Do you have a problem right now?" is a marvellous antidote to low-level stress. And I certainly could never have finished writing this book without Shoma Marita's insight that there's no need to get motivated before you get on and act. In friendships and in my relationship with my girlfriend, I came to understand more deeply that happiness and vulnerability are often the same thing. And at least once a week, I have reason to call to mind Albert Ellis's distinction between a very bad outcome and an absolutely terrible one. Imagining worst-case scenarios is one of my greatest sources of solace in life, actually. When you really try to answer, rationally and in detail, the question, what's the worst that could happen? The answer is sometimes pretty bad. But it is finitely bad, rather than infinitely terrifying, so there's always a chance of coping with it. Or at least I think there is. I'm acutely aware that during the time I spent exploring this perspective on life, no great tragedies befell me, and my family and friends largely thrived. Like a good Stoic, I tried to stay conscious of that, so as to derive happiness from feeling gratitude for my good fortune. But for me personally, the real test of these philosophies may lie in the future. Already, though, I can see that where these techniques ultimately lead is to somewhere beyond techniques, to a different definition of happiness itself. The real revelation of the negative path was not so much the path as the destination. Embracing negativity as a technique, in the end, really makes sense only if the happiness you're aiming for is one that can accommodate negative as well as positive emotions. The aforementioned Paul Pearsall, inventor of Openture, spent a large part of his life waging a lonely battle of which John Keats would surely have approved, to get the concept of awe accepted by the psychological establishment as one of the primary human emotions, alongside such standards as love, joy, anger, fear, and sadness. Unlike all the other emotions, he argued, awe is all of our feelings rolled up into one intense one. You can't peg it as just happy, sad, afraid, angry, or hopeful. Instead, it's a matter of experiencing all these feelings, and yet, paradoxically, experiencing no clearly identifiable, or at least any easily describable, emotion. Awe, he writes, is like trying to assemble a complex jigsaw puzzle with pieces missing. There's never any closure in an awe-inspired life, only constant acceptance of the mysteries of life. We're never allowed to know where this fantastic voyage might end, but that's part of the life-disorienting chaos that makes this choice so thrillingly difficult. Which seems, to me, as good a description as any of a happiness that's worthy of the name. This kind of happiness has nothing to do with the easy superficialities of positive thinking, with the grinning insistence on optimism at all costs, or the demand that success be guaranteed. It involves much more difficulty, and also much more authenticity, than that. The negative path to happiness, then, is a different kind of path, but it is also a path to a different kind of destination. Or maybe it makes more sense to say that the path is the destination. These things are excruciatingly hard to put into words, and the spirit of negative capability surely dictates that we do not struggle too hard to do so. A good traveller has no fixed plans, says the Chinese sage Lao Tzu, and is not intent upon arriving. There could be no better way to make the journey. You've been listening to The Antidote by Oliver Berkman. Text copyright 2012 Oliver Berkman. This recording licensed by Canongate Books Limited, 2013. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.